If you're really going to understand the Old Testament book you're reading, you have to know what's going on with Israel. So I talked to a guy this morning. It was interesting. We were talking about the book of Amos. He started reading the book of Amos. Like, man, that's so cool. One of our young guys are working through the book of Amos. So cool. And I was like, and he said, but it didn't make sense. You know why? Because he didn't know what was going on with Israel. You have to take the time, understand, who is Amos talking to? If you know who Amos is talking to, then the book will come alive to you. It'll make more sense, okay? So we work through it. Say, you know, we kind of work through Old Testament history, and I don't know if he was fading out or not, but this is, it's so important. Like, if you're really going to know and understand an Old Testament book, you have to take the time and go through the history. And you're going, well, Mike, this is the last Old Testament book. Are you going to go through the whole history of the Old Testament? Yes, but just the Cliff Note version. So maybe 10 minutes or so. But it starts where? Garden of Eden, right? It starts in the Garden of Eden where there's perfection. God creates perfection. There's no sin. There's no death. And he puts two people in the garden, Adam and Eve. And then Adam and Eve disobey God. And their sin brought about death and corruption and a curse. In Genesis 3, there's a glimmer of hope that comes along when he said that Eve's seed is going to crush the head of the serpent. Really speaking, fast-forwarding to the New Testament where the Son of God would die for sin. Okay, it's a foreshadowing of Jesus' death for sin. And it gives hope. Right, Genesis 3, the proto-evangelium, the first gospel, gives hope that in the midst of this curse and destruction and sin and rebellion, that there's this glimmer of hope that a future redeemer is going to come. Okay, Noah's flood happens. The entire earth is covered with water. Only Noah and his family survive. They end up getting off the ark eventually, the earth. They populate the earth, and the people try to build this huge tower to ultimately to exalt themselves. And God is not pleased, and so he scatters them into different languages, and they form the nations. But God chooses one man, a man named Abram. We know him as Abraham. Abram's not even a worshiper of God. In fact, he comes from a family of idol worshipers. And he tells him, I'm going to make you a great nation. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. In you, Abram, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Why? Because of Abram's offspring. Well, the problem is, like, Abram's an old man. He's 80 years old. His wife is 60. They're way past childbearing years. And yet Abraham believes God, and God reckons to him his righteousness. But it takes 30 years to fulfill that promise. And they have a son, and they name him Isaac. Isaac, which means laughter, because Sarah's like, ha, I'm going to have a baby? Are you kidding me? Yeah, you think that's funny? Call your kid laughter then. Isaac has twin boys, and these boys don't get along so well. First one is named Esau, which means hairy. He's like a chia pet. Okay, the second is Jacob. Jacob means liar or deceiver or tricker, and he lives up to his name. He steals his brother's birthright. He steals his brother's blessing. Because he steals it, he runs away. And in the midst of him running away, God says, Jacob, I'm going to fulfill my promise to bless the nations by bringing the Messiah through you. And so Jacob, the liar, the deceiver, the tricker, he runs off and he moves in with his mom's family and he marries two sisters as wives. Now, if you've ever thought about doing that, that is not a good idea. Okay? Just read about Jacob. And so he's got these sister wives. And between the sister wives, they have 12 sons who make up the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, I thought his name was Jacob, not Israel. Well, on his way back to his homeland, Jacob falls asleep, and he has a wrestling match with God. You see it in the Bible, is he has a wrestling match with the angel of the Lord. And this match lasted all night long. And when morning comes, Jacob hangs on to the angel's foot, to God's foot, and he's begging him, give me your blessing. And God says, I'm changing your name, changing it from liar, Jacob, to Israel, one who strives with God. And so these 12 sons, all of them reject the one son that he loved so much. It was Joseph. I'm sorry, 10 of them rejected him. And they sell him into slavery. And in their minds, Joseph is dead. Ultimately, God raises up Joseph through all kinds of heinous trials, raises him up so that he becomes second in charge of Israel, even though he's a slave. Okay, and he saves Israel from famine. Well, what's that a picture of? Well, it's a picture of Jesus, the beloved son of his father who was rejected by his brothers and sold into the hands of the Gentiles. And he raises to the right hand of his father. Why? To save his people. Same as Joseph. Well, just before Jacob dies, or Israel, we could say, he blesses one of his 12 sons. And you'd think it'd be Joseph, right? Joseph is the leader. He's the man. But it's not. It's Judah, who wasn't really a great guy. But he blesses Judah. Look at Genesis 49. He says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." And so the Messiah is going to come from Judah. He's going to be the seed of the woman through Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob, and through Judah. And what the Bible does is just continually narrows down the people that the Messiah would come through. So when we did our Christmas sermon on Matthew, right, the genealogy, like that's why those genealogies are important. They're not just filler in the Bible because, you know, somebody opted to have their name in, or God's like, oh, this would be cool. Put his name in there. See how Mike has to try to pronounce this years from now, right? They're important. All of it is important. And so he's going to be the seed of a woman. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah. And it just keeps narrowing it down. Now, the theme throughout the Old Testament is God's warning to Israel. If you obey me, I'm going to bless you. And if you disobey me, then you're going to undergo a curse and you're going to be scattered. Well, they disobey. Now the nation of Israel, they move to Egypt under Joseph's protection, and they grow and they grow and they grow there. Joseph dies and a new Pharaoh comes in and he puts Israel in slavery. Right, you know the story, Prince of Egypt, right? Charlton Heston, all that stuff. Moses, plagues, Red Sea, wilderness, right? Then they go into the promised land under Joshua. Remember, we studied Joshua last year. And God is their king. So they take the promised land, they get in there, and then they scatter and they inhabit the land. And eventually they say, well, we don't really want God as our king. And God's saying, listen, if you get an earthly king, you're going to undergo all kinds of issues. And they say, well, we want a king because our neighbors have a king. God says, you don't want a king. And they said, no, we really want a king. We want to be like the other folks. Like they sound like teenagers, right? And so they wouldn't listen. They reject God as their king. And so he assigns the prophet Samuel. And he has the job of finding Israel's new king. And he finds tall, dark, and fine Saul. Right? He becomes Israel's first king. But Saul isn't a good king. So in the middle of his reign, God anoints a regular shepherd boy named David to be king. And David has some pretty major issues, doesn't he? But he's actually Israel's best king. He is the greatest king to come from Israel. You know what tribe David's from? Judah. And it's David's throne that the Messiah will eventually sit on. Well, after David, his son Solomon takes the throne. And under these first three kings, Israel is united. So when you're reading an Old Testament book, you want to ask the question, is Israel united right now under Saul, David, and Solomon? Or are they divided? Is it a divided kingdom? Well, when did they get divided? Well, Solomon dies, and his son Rehoboam takes the throne. Rehoboam goes to the elders, hey, what should I do? How should I rule? And the elders say, you should be gentle with the people. You should rule with kindness and compassion. And he's like, I'm going to ask my friends and see what they think. So he goes to his friends, and of course they're thinking, ooh, we could have a part in this. And they said, you should rule with an iron fist. And so who do you think he follows? His friends. And that decision divided the nation. 10 of the tribes rebel with Rehoboam. Okay, he's the brother of Jeroboam. And the nation splits into two kingdoms. Okay, so you have the north, which we'll call them the Yankees, okay? You have the Yankees to the north, and you have the Confederates to the south, okay? And you go, well, who leads who? Jeroboam leads the Yankees, okay? Jeroboam, J is before R, right? So Jeroboam to the north, Rehoboam to the south. Now the Yankees, Israel, they have no good kings at all. Okay, not one good king. They lasted 209 years, and then the Assyrians overtook them. The Confederates, I was going to call them the rebels, but I'm like, it doesn't sound right. If you want to think in your mind rebels, then you think they're the bad ones. But actually, Judah, the Confederates, they were better. They had some good kings. It took them 345 years before Babylon takes them into captivity. So let me just give you a really easy way to remember this, all right? Because this is important. In fact, I pulled up Amos a few minutes ago just to show you. So when you look at the book of Amos, right, it starts off with the words of Amos, who was among the sheep herders from Tekoa, which he envisioned in visions concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Okay, is Judah north or south? South, good. So Judah is a southern kingdom. So you go, this might have been a good king. Was Uzziah a good king or a bad king? Good king till the end, right? So he was a good king until the end when he thought that he could be the prophet and priest and king, and then he ended up dying as a leper. But okay, so now we understand if we're reading Amos, Amos is prophesying, he is preaching, he is teaching to the southern kingdom, Judah, during the time when they have a good king. Does that make sense? You see how it comes together? So you go, well, how do I remember this? Okay, easy way to remember, this is how I do it, okay? I is before J. Israel before Judah. I, north, is Judah in the south, okay? J is before R. So Jeroboam over Israel, Rehoboam over Judah. A is before B. The Assyrians took away Jeroboam's northern kingdom of Israel. Babylon, B, takes away Rehoboam's southern kingdom of Judah. Okay? So if you just go, okay, well, I know the names. I just don't remember if they're north or south. Just remember the south are the good guys for the most part. North were the bad guys the whole time. Okay? So south gets taken out. Right, Judah gets taken out by Nebuchadnezzar. He is the king of Babylon. What book is that, by the way? Daniel. Yeah, the book of Daniel, right? So he not only takes Judah into captivity, he destroys Jerusalem. Okay, absolutely pummels the place, the temple, the walls. He leaves it in shambles. 70 years later, the Persians attack the Babylonians. And the king of Persia says, listen, Jews, if you want to go back to your homeland, you can. Okay, so they have somewhat of a second exodus, right? First exodus was out of Egypt, second exodus out of Babylon, okay? Nowhere near as impressive as the first exodus because only a remnant actually left. But they went back in three waves. And so the first wave is Ezra, okay, led by a guy named Zerubbabel. He leads the first wave, and in the first wave, what they do is they rebuild the temple. So they got this great church there, okay? It took them 20 years to do it, though. Okay, they got sidetracked. They got distracted, and so instead of building God's house, they just kind of did other things, and, oh, when we get to it, we'll do it. The second wave, because the temple's built now, so the second wave happens, and Ezra is doing this, leading the second wave, in order to build the spiritual condition of the people. Okay, so the first wave, what do they build in the first wave? The temple. Second wave, they rebuild the people. Okay, third wave, what's the third wave? The book of Nehemiah. Okay, does that make sense? And I know it's a lot of information, but this is the end. This is where it's going to, and so they rebuild Jerusalem. That's why Jesus can go into Jerusalem. It's now a city now, okay? And so the temple's been built, but the city's empty because there aren't any walls. There's no protection. And so the people are discouraged. I mean, they're just getting by, but they're struggling. And in their minds, there's little hope of having a city to call their own. Okay, that's the background. That's what brings us to where we are today. Now let's go back to Nehemiah, and we'll start in verse 1, and we're just going to pick these three verses apart one at a time, and I think it'll all make sense. Okay, verse 1, the first part, it says, "Now the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah." Okay, this book is a journal. It's Nehemiah's journal. Now think about it. His parents were in exile. Okay, they probably taught him about Yahweh. At the end of verse 11, it says that Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king, which brings us to our second point, which is the character of Nehemiah, the character of Nehemiah. Because when you hear cupbearer, you might be thinking waiter or butler or flight attendant, right? It's not. Cupbearer is a very important position. In fact, we would say it was the equivalent of like a prime minister. Okay, so get this. Nehemiah is this normal guy. He grows up in captivity in a pagan country, and he worked a secular job, and God used him mightily. Was he married? Probably not. Why would you say that? Well, most cupbearers were eunuchs, so they couldn't be married. And I don't want to just like kind of pass that over. Like, I'd really like to challenge our single people. Because it happens a lot of times in churches, is you get a church and they go, "Oh, well, you know, the married folks will handle this, and the older people will do this ministry." And then the younger single guys are just kind of, you know, waiting till one day I get married, then I'm going to be useful, or one day I'll get married, I'll have a family, or one day I'll just grow up. No, really, listen, God uses single people. Don't wait for that. Go hold babies. Work in the nursery. Man, we need help teaching our Sunday school classes. You know, where else do you think you're going to get good training to be a good dad and a good mom? I mean, you can come babysit my kids, but you could do the nursery as well. You could help out teaching Sunday school. Hold a Bible study in your house. Why don't you do a backyard Bible club at your home? Why not? You got the energy. You got the time. You know, we've got trips coming up. We've got a trip to South Africa we're planning. I'd love to see some young people sign up for that. Nehemiah was a single man for the most part, almost guaranteed. And God used him as a cupbearer. Well, what's a cupbearer? Well, in those days, kings were getting killed by their own people. In fact, that's what happened to his dad. King Artaxerxes, his dad, and his own brother, his own dad died, and his own brother tried to kill him once already. So here's Nehemiah working in the palace. He didn't leave with the first two waves. I imagine he could have. And I believe that's because God had work for him to do. And it was work that he couldn't have accomplished elsewhere. And so God put Nehemiah in Susa, just like he put Esther in Susa, a generation before, just as he put Joseph in Egypt, just as he put Daniel in Babylon, and God has put you where you live and where you work and where you play. Because when God has work to accomplish, he puts his workers in the right place at the right time, and that's you. And so the cupbearer, he had a job, and his job was to taste the food and the wine and make sure it wasn't poisoned. You go, well, couldn't his wife do that? Well, even his wife couldn't be trusted. Because if his wife wanted her firstborn son to be king, what did she got to do? Slip a little something into daddy's drink. Right? And all of a sudden, my boy is king. And so Nehemiah would have been trusted by the king. He would have had access to the king at all times. He would have given advice to the king. I mean, he was so influential. He wasn't just a food critic going, you know, I think you should try the lobster and not the steak. Actually, he wouldn't have said lobster because they were Jewish. Look at the second part of verse 1. He says, "Now it happened in the month of Chislev, the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital." Okay, Chislev. That's November, December time frame. Okay, November, December, it's the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign. And they're in Susa. Well, what's Susa? Susa is the winter capital because it was too hot in the summer. So they couldn't go, they wouldn't live in Susa in the summertime. It was just too hot. So the king would move his staff and everybody else, and they live in Susa in the wintertime. So we would say this, the king was a snowbird, okay? So he went down to Florida when it was hot. Okay, his brother, Hanani, comes from Judah to Susa. That's verse 2, right? You see it? That Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. Now, Hanani comes, and you go, okay, well, is this like going from, say, Ocala to Orlando? No, further than that. Is this going from Ocala to Miami? No, further than that. This is a six-month journey. Okay, this is a long journey. My guess is he hasn't seen his brother in years. My guess is it's been at least 15 since the other waves left. So this had to be exciting. You know, Nehemiah sees his brother, and he's probably thinking, oh, I just want to hear about Jerusalem. I'm sure Jerusalem's doing well now. I mean, it's been years since they've gone. There's probably a mega church in the city. And so the last thing he knows is that the temple was rebuilt and the people were being rebuilt. But there's no filler in the Bible, right? There are three names in these first two verses. And I think knowing what their names mean is really purposeful, because there's brokenness and there's a lack of hope and a lack of joy among the people. The name Nehemiah, that Yah in the back, that's Yahweh, right? So Nehemiah means Yahweh is comfort. Here's his, just think about his parents, that they name this child Nehemiah, God is comfort, while they're in the middle of strife and suffering and captivity. God is comfort. And then his brother, I'm sorry, then his dad, Hakaliah, again, that Yah means Yahweh, right? And his name means wait on Yahweh. Hakaliah, wait on Yahweh. So Yahweh is comfort, Nehemiah, wait on Yahweh, Hakaliah. And then Hanani, that you can, in the Hebrew, you can see the Yah there too, which is Yahweh is gracious. I mean, what neat parents, huh? To name their kids God is comfort and God is gracious. And he gives them those names in the middle of captivity and in the middle of darkness. Point number three is the inquiry of Nehemiah. The inquiry of Nehemiah. Essentially, Nehemiah has two questions. How are God's people, and how is God's city? And he asks, how is God's city? Because as Jerusalem goes, so goes God's people. Jerusalem is the heart of the nation. So if I went to a senator and I said, hey, senator, how's Washington? I'm not asking about the traffic. I'm not asking about the cherry blossoms. I'm not asking about the people. What am I asking about? The politics. How are the politics in Washington, right? In Nehemiah's case, when he says, how's the city, what he's asking is, how's the worship? How's the worship, right? Because as Jerusalem goes, so goes God's people. Look at Hanani's response in verse 3. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province has survived the captivity, or who survived the captivity, are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And that was probably just putting out the fire. Brother comes, everybody's excited. Tell me, how's Jerusalem? There's a big church now, a bunch of people getting saved, all kinds of great things happening. He says, no. It's not good. And I thought, isn't it kind of interesting that God is gracious, Hanani tells God is comfort, Nehemiah, Jerusalem's not good. It's not good. And the three words he uses, remnant, ruin, and reproach. The remnant, ruin, and reproach. And so Nehemiah, listen, there's not this great land that's inhabited by a great nation. There's just a remnant, just a small group of people. And the small group of people that's there, they are in affliction. They're struggling to survive. And Nehemiah, I know you'd love for me to tell you that Jerusalem is this great and magnificent city, and I'll just tell you it's in shambles. And Nehemiah, it used to be great glory from the city, and now it's nothing but great reproach. I mean, he is telling them nothing is good about it. Isn't there a temple? Yeah, there's a temple, but there's no worship. There's a city, but there's no walls. He said, we don't even have gates. Nobody's going to live in an unprotected city. If nobody lives in the unprotected city, then nobody worships in the temple. We don't do Passover. We don't do Feasts of Booths, right? We don't do any of that stuff. There's no sacrificing. It is absolute chaos. Look at Proverbs 25, verse 28. He says, like a city that is broken into and without walls is a man who has no control over his spirit. A city without walls is chaos. That's Jerusalem. I mean, even to think that, well, surely even if you lived outside the city, you'd still walk to the temple, right, and do sacrifices. Yeah, who's going to risk it? Who's going to bring their family along those narrow streets in Jerusalem where the thieves would be there hiding, right? And so they rob you and they beat you and they mug you and they take your sacrifice. Who's going to do that? None of us. Same thing's happening in Jerusalem. Business isn't happening because there aren't any gates. Remember, the gates are where the elders ruled. The gates were where commerce happened. Gates were where you bought and sold. Nehemiah, there's no business. There's no worship. You want to know how Jerusalem is? It's no good. It's absolute chaos. In fact, it's worse now than it was 70 years before when they were taken into captivity. That's the brokenness. That's the emptiness. That's the sheer hopelessness that faces Nehemiah. And it's like, well, Nehemiah, you asked. How's it doing? You know, we get into that trap, don't we? I've been driving recently, and every time I come up 36th Avenue, around 45 to 50 miles an hour, I feel this shudder in my car. And I'm thinking, oh, man, something new on the road. And then I'm starting to notice it other places, too. But I don't really want to ask about it because I'm afraid of what it might be. Sherry drives my car, and you know what she does? She asks about it. What is that noise it's making? Ah, I was hoping it was just me. I don't want to ask because I don't want to know. Nehemiah asked because he wanted to know. And through this book, what we're going to see is that God is going to restore worship to this nation. Like, that's the direction we're going. And so there are tons of books written on the book of Nehemiah. Most of them are leadership books. Okay, but the more I read it, I tell you, listen, this is not a book about how to build a wall in 50 days, 52 days. This is not a book about how to build a church or how to run a Christian business. This isn't a book about how to reach a city with the gospel. This is a book about restoring worship. In fact, that's the priority. The walls are down so the people aren't worshiping. Everything's normal, so to speak, until Nehemiah asks the question. Until Nehemiah makes an inquiry. He asks about Jerusalem's wall and God's people. I mean, why does he even care? Have you ever thought about it? Why does he even care? He's got a good job, right? I mean, he's a cupbearer to the king. These guys are hundreds of miles away. He's successful. He's secure. I mean, what's my fault that my ancestors sinned, right? That's on them. It's not my fault. Well, Nehemiah inquired because Nehemiah cared. He cared about Jerusalem. He cared about God's people. He cared about God being worshipped. He inquired, I believe, because he wanted the facts, even though they knew they might be painful. Well, how does this apply? Point number four, the application of Nehemiah. I don't think it's a stretch to say that we live in a day of brokenness and emptiness and hopelessness. I don't think it's a stretch to say that God has been excommunicated from our public forums I don't think it's a stretch to say that Christians are being mocked for purity. You know, you just name and think about the most wicked sin you can, and I can guarantee you, you will have no shortage of college professors and government leaders and cultural stars that will endorse it and justify it. And it can seem like God has absolutely abandoned his people. And I think that's what Israel thought as well when Jerusalem was in shambles. I think they thought that God had forgotten them. Look at Isaiah 49. What Isaiah says, he says, can a woman forget her nursing child and have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget. In other words, even if they did forget, God says, but I will not forget you. Behold, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands, and your walls are continually before me. God has not forgotten you. He's not forgotten your pain and the brokenness and the emptiness and the sheer hopelessness that you think you might be in right now. He has not forgotten. God never forgot them. You know what happened to them? Bad leadership. That's what led to the demise of Jerusalem. And I would say you could see it really start with three guys, Solomon, Jeroboam, and Rehoboam. Solomon, incredibly gifted, right? But he couldn't control his passions. Jeroboam was weak, and he wanted power. And Rehoboam was privileged, but he was unteachable. These leaders led the nation astray. In fact, you can look at almost any movement of moral decay and just look to the leadership and see what brought them to this point. And what you're going to see is you're going to see the blurring of lines among the leadership. A blurring between right and wrong, good and evil, moral and immoral. And I would say we see those lines now being blurred. Bad has become good. Even within the Christian church, we have those with uncontrolled passion, just like Solomon. We have power-hungry people, just like Jeroboam. We have the unteachable Rehoboams. That's our challenge. And we have prioritized everything except for God. And so the wall of moral purity and integrity and personal responsibility have been broken down. And I'm going to tell you, the world is absolutely rejoicing over it. And there are churches, and there are people, and there is no worship. That's our challenge, is to worship. Nehemiah sees this challenge, and he says, okay, I have a responsibility to do something about it. He could have turned a blind eye. He's got a great job. He's got a cushy job. He's hanging with the king. But he doesn't. Wait, that's the message of the Bible, really, is who's available. Remember in Isaiah when God said, well, who will go? What did Isaiah say? Here am I, send me. When God asked somebody to stand in the gap, Ezekiel said, I'll do it. God needed a builder. Nehemiah became his man. But it started with Nehemiah's inquiry. Here he is doing life on an ordinary day, and his brother shows up and asks him a question. How are your walls? Just think through, how are your walls? Have they been broken down, and has the enemy come in and taken away worship? What's become more important than your relationship with God? What has become more important than protecting the souls of those you love? Nehemiah asked because Nehemiah cared, and I'm telling you, I am asking you because I love you and I care for you. And you know where your walls are down. You know the compromises you've made. You know how you've sacrificed best things for shiny things. Tori Johnson, one of the founders of Youth for Christ, was asked to speak at a school, and he couldn't make it. It was a high school assembly, and he couldn't make it. And he recommended an unknown preacher named Billy Graham to come there. And the school had never heard of them, and so they were going to cancel the event. And Tori Johnson said, "You won't regret it. Let Billy speak." And so they agreed, and Billy Graham went and spoke. And so they met up afterwards, and he asked him how it went. Dr. Graham said, "I don't think it went so well. Only one person responded to the gospel." He said, "Could you write his name down, and just would you pray for him?" That man was Warren Wiersbe. And you go, "Who's that?" He's the guy that teaches you nearly every Sunday morning. I study his commentaries at length. 2 Chronicles 16:9 says this, "For the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his." It was just another day when Hanani shows up. And Nehemiah's life is never going to be the same because Nehemiah's heart is completely for God. It was just another day when Moses was out there tending his sheep, right? And God called him to be his prophet. Just another day when David's out shepherding his flock and God anointed him as king. Just another day when Peter and Andrew and James and John are out there mending their nets after this unsuccessful day fishing or night fishing. And Jesus said, "Today you will be fishers of men." Just another day. The worship team will come down. The one thing that all of these had in common, Nehemiah, Moses, David, right? One thing they had all had in common was their availability. They were available. When you ask, are you available? Like, ask, am I really available to God using me? Am I available to be moved out of my comfort zone? God will use you greatly if you're available. He'll equip you if you're available. He's not asking you to do anything extraordinary. Just be faithful. And so you're available as a normal man, normal woman, whose heart is fully God's, to be fully supported by him. That's where Nehemiah was. And God used him greatly. Let's pray together. Our God, we want to be used by you. So now, just sitting there in your chairs, you know those walls that have been broken down, that many of them that you broke down on your own, that have allowed the enemy to come in and get a foothold and worship isn't happening. You know, a great thing about the Christian life is that when we confess, and God forgives. Confess those things to the Lord. Ask him to forgive you. Purpose in your heart to be used by God, to be available for him. Now, Father, I thank you for this book of Nehemiah. What a great reminder it is of just a man, a regular guy who's just faithful and available to your work. God, may we be that way as well. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.